Welcome back to Following Noah on a Stormlight Podcast. This week is our Wind and Truth previews week number 10, and we're in chapters 19 and 20. David, how are you?
Tired, taking care of a newborn, but I'm hanging in there.
Glad to hear it. Tim, how are you?
I'm doing great. I just got back from a short little hike, so I'm ready to get into talking about this.
Sounds good. When we started these preview episodes, I very foolishly put out that they'd be half hour, or that's what we would be trying for. But surely, if there were any week that we could go on the short end towards a half hour as opposed to an hour, it would be this week. So that's when anyone who is listening to this and can see the runtime will know if that's true or not. But let's roll intro. And then we have some epigraphs from the Way of Kings before chapters 19 and 20. All right. Anyone else like to read our epigraphs?
No. Sure. Go ahead.
Go for it, David.
No, I don't. I can't say I understand them, but I'll read them. A land where the king was a holy man and was concerned with the plight of the farmer beyond the appropriation of taxes. I let them pass with two lies.
So the rest of our excerpts from The Way of Kings, I felt like made perfect sense, even out of context. Even with the context of Noadon presumably has met this other group from a different culture of his. I don't get where these fit in with that story that he's telling. I don't understand.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of being concerned with the farmer beyond how much you can tax them, like that's in line with other things we've read in The Way of Kings. Like, you know, he's like, oh, I'll carry the thing, or I don't remember the exact quote, but
yeah, the one
like how can you ask someone to do something if you haven't done it yourself, that sort of philosophy,
right?
I don't understand the I let them pass with two lies, because is he talking about the people telling him the story, or
or did he lie, or did he not correct them and is considering that a lie?
I wonder if our next epigraph is, I wonder if he's about to lie to them, and that's what he's saying. I let them pass with two lies, which are this and this. So I think this will actually be answered by next week. I assume, I hope.
All I can think of is those riddles where there's two guys in front of doors and yeah. One tells the truth and one lies. Like, I don't know. Like, you can pass if you tell me two lies.
Yeah.
I don't know. We're just going to need more context.
Yeah, I don't know if there's too much more we can discuss with these ones. Do you guys have anything? All right. Then straight into chapter 19, which, out of all of the chapters that we've gotten in Wind and Truth, this one seemed the most straightforward. Zeth and Kaladin show up in Shinnevar, and I listen to Michael Kramer for this excerpt, and the way he says it's a Zeth point of view, and the way Zeth says the word soil, like it's like the first time you've ever seen the word in Stormlight Archive, like it's from Zeth's point of view, is like, and there was soil. Whoa, I just thought that was really funny. the whole chapter, I mean, there's a couple one-liners that we can discuss a little bit further, but basically the whole chapter is Zeth and Kaladin show up, they see dirt, they see a weed, and Kaladin and Syl are like, that's weird. And that's the whole chapter.
Yeah, I didn't like, because we already had a chapter like this, right? We already had Risen.
Right.
Being like, why is the grass dumb? And there was a whole lot of stuff about why is the grass dumb? And now we get Kaladin doing the same thing. So it's like, do we really need all that? there is one thing I did want to talk about, which I didn't put in the notes. So before I forget, there's a line from Zeth. So Kaladin was trying to startle the plant, but he didn't actually crush the plant. He stopped before he did so.
Right.
And Zeth says, "This is a man who pulls back before crushing a weed." And then, you know, as a follow-up to that thought, which we assume that this line is related to that thought, "No wonder you broke and gave up the spear, leaving your friends to battle without you. You have grown into a coward then." And I really puzzled on this line for a while, because obviously Kaladin took it as an insult.
Right.
Like, you shouldn't insult people like that. And Zeth's just like, "What do you mean? I'm just saying the truth." So I went to thinking about how in Shin culture, the soldier is the lowest of the things you can do, right? Whereas in Alethi culture, being a soldier is one of the highest things you can do. And Kaladin talks about that when he's young, right? He's like, "Yeah, farmers are important, but soldiers are more, you know, are considered more." And so, but Zeth would be speaking Alethi here. So the Alethi may have a word that means essentially a pacifist that would have a neutral or positive connotation. Whereas Alethi, sorry, did I say Alethi?
You did, but I understand what you're like.
Yeah, so the Shin would have a word
for
pacifist that would have positive connotation.
Right.
And then Alethi would only have a word for pacifist with a negative connotation.
Right, derogatory.
And so he's trying to, you know, speak in Alethi, a concept that would be translated from the Shin language, where his thoughts are. So I think Zeth did not intend this to be negative. I think he's just observing, saying, "Oh, you're not a soldier anymore. You've grown beyond that."
Right.
Because in the Shin culture, you don't want to be a soldier.
But he's using the word coward, and Kaladin like took offense at that. Right.
Exactly. Because Zeth wouldn't take the same negative connotation to that word as Kaladin does.
Interesting. Interesting.
That's my thought about that. It's like a cultural misunderstanding rather than Zeth just outright insulting him to his face and not knowing why that's wrong.
Mm-hmm. I think that's part of it. Definitely. That's an interesting thing to consider. I was thinking the cultural end as well, but also abandoning your fellows, no matter what culture you're from, that's a bad thing.
He didn't say abandon, though. He said leaving your friends to battle without you.
Okay.
So he's like, yeah, your friends are still battling, but you're not joining them. The only reason you do that is if you're now pacifist. You don't want to harm.
Yeah.
I'm reading too much into this, but to me, it feels like, you know, that's why Zeth didn't feel like he shouldn't say it. But it's possible that there's a more, the surface level reading is more accurate of Zeth just thinks that speaking the truth can never be insulting.
Sure.
But so, yeah, I don't know. I wanted your guys' thoughts on which one you think is more likely.
I read it what you just said there of how am I being offensive? I'm just observing, right? I'm just telling you what I see, and I don't think that's offensive. But I do actually like where you're going with this, where it could be a translation issue, and I think that's an interesting idea.
I was actually thinking about how English like doesn't have a good word for that. A coward, but with positive connotation.
Right.
Pacifist was the closest I could come up with, but even pacifist doesn't necessarily have a positive connotation in a lot of contexts.
Sure.
Yeah, because the word coward like implies lacking something that you should have.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We get this Zeth point of view. And I was trying to think, I think the last Zeth point of view we had was him killing Taravangian? Or is that a Taravangian point of view? That's a Taravangian point of view.
Oathbringer had Zeth point of view. Oh, him killing Taravangi. No, sorry. You're talking about Rhythm War.
Yes.
For some reason, what came to mind was the end of Way of Kings, where he first meets Taravangian. But that is not what you said.
No. The I think we had Zeth point of view in Rhythm of War. I assume we did. I can't think of...
He's leaning against a tree guarding Dalinar.
Oh, yeah. Nightblood's like sitting next to him, talking to him. That does exist, so it is at least Rhythm of War. So, what I wanted to say was, I don't remember Zeth being this unstable, and his Spren talking to him like this, and his voices like freaking him out this much. I remember he's had the voices in his head. He's been on kind of crazy. Like that's all been with Zeth for a while. I felt as I was reading this, Sanderson's leaning into this a lot. Like something's gonna happen with Zeth. Before this chapter, I assumed that Zeth and Kaladin were gonna go to Shinnevar. They were gonna work together. It's gonna be great. They're gonna figure out whatever's going on. I don't know if Zeth's coming back from this quest now. I think Sanderson is leaning in quite heavily to no, Zeth is not okay going into this quest.
I will say that I think this is the first time we've even heard from his Spren.
I think we've heard from it once before in
really
at the end of Oathbringer. I think when he first meets it, it talks to him like very briefly. But okay. This is like the actual full conversation for the first time. I do think that's true.
Yeah. Now, before we get on to the Spren, because I think that there's some discussion there. I just wanted to say that it's possible Sanderson's leading into Zeth's insanity because Kaladin's supposed to help him with that.
Okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so it could be an arc of him recovering a bit from his spiral, thanks to Kaladin in some way.
Sure.
Because there's a sort of the whole Kaladin, the therapist thing that Sanderson seems to really be pushing. So.
Yeah. I hope it goes that way. Moving into some of the Zeth dialogue there, I wanted to point out the chapter title for 19, Ruled by Voices. That's something you definitely see very strongly in this chapter for Zeth. Absolutely controlled and to the extreme by the voices that he hears. He uses it as a defense mechanism. He doesn't know what to trust or what to do, so he just does whatever he's told. And this Spren, honestly, is really taking advantage of him. And we've never seen a Spren of honor that is an active antagonist. But I think this Spren really is.
Yeah.
And but, you can see... Oh, go ahead.
But before we get talking directly about the Spren, just with Zeth, I felt like this was a backtrack for Zeth. I felt like this was a backtrack for Zeth because in Words of Radiance specifically, you get Zeth's point of view, and the voices are really prevalent. You're like, okay, this guy is insane. And then he dies and then comes back. And then the entirety of Oathbringer, he's hanging out with Nail. And I at least had the impression of, okay, the sane one here is Zeth, not Nail. Like he goes and hangs out with the Skybreakers for a book and then comes back and hangs out with Dalinar for a while in Rhythm of War. And I don't know, at the end of Rhythm of War, I thought Zeth was going to be fairly stable, but I don't think that anymore.
I think that when it comes to mental health, certain things can really make you spiral worse. And Zeth just had two pretty traumatic experiences. One was the battle with Ishar, where Ishar tells him, yeah, I killed your dad and took my honor blade back, along with whatever else he did in Shinnevar. And then, like, almost right after, he has the thing with Taravangian. And we don't really know how Zeth handled what happened with Taravangian there. or what he experienced with that. So that could have set him back for sure. One thing I did want to mention is there's more than just the voices of the dead that Zeth hears. He also hears Nightblood and his friend.
Yeah.
But in terms of the voices of the dead, do we think there's something magical going on, like tapping into the spiritual realm, or is this just normal insanity?
I think it's an indication of where his mental health is at. I think you're right. Because he was talking about how they had gone away. He thought they were gone and they weren't coming back. And then he just went through some really traumatic stuff. And all of a sudden it's back again. And that is very normal with regular trauma and things like that.
Yeah. One step forward, two steps backward.
Yeah. I've never attributed anything super magical to it. That being said, I'd be open to it. I don't know what that would look like, but if that did turn out to be something with the spiritual realm going on, that it wouldn't surprise me, and I wouldn't be like taken aback by it.
Yeah, this book is very spiritual realm heavy already.
Right.
I think we're supposed to be learning a lot about it in this book. I'm excited to, but so that's one of the reasons I'm thinking, well, maybe every plot line involves the spiritual realm in some way.
I also wonder if that's one of the reasons why Zeth was pushed to book 5 instead of book 3. I wonder if we needed to learn about the cognitive realm first and before we learned about the spiritual realm, because Zeth might have something to do. Like you're saying, Zeth might be more connected to the spiritual realm stuff than we think.
I mean, I always assumed it was because we needed to learn about Dalinar's past in order for the Oathbringer plot to work.
Right.
Like we wouldn't have understood what happened in part 5 of Oathbringer if we didn't have Dalinar flashbacks, if we had Zeth flashbacks instead. So, but yeah, I mean, maybe that was another like reason, is that we also wouldn't understand Zeth's backstory without the plot of book 5. So
right.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit more about the way the Spren is acting. So the way that the Spren is talking to Zeth and really controlling him, trying to get him to suppress his emotions, it's very manipulative, it's very harmful, and honestly it is abusive. So I'm very curious to learn more about this relationship and why is the Spren acting this way? Is this normal for what type of Spren are they?
High Spren.
Yeah. Is this normal for High Spren?
Well, we do have one other example of Ox, and Ox did not behave that way. Now, right. Ox was also not all there. He was like a fragment left. But there was no hint of any of that with Ogs. This leans into my kind of theory that the High Spren got corrupted in some way. The in general, the Skybreakers got corrupted in some way. We know Zigzal ends up being leader of some kind of Skybreaker order.
Right.
And I'm wondering if he helps repair that. Because, Nail being the leader and then Nail being insane, that can't be good.
Right.
At the same time, we know that the High Spren were the only Spren who didn't seem to care about whatever happened with the Recreants. And in general, the Order didn't care. So there's definitely something different about those Spren. And then just one more thing. We also know that the Honor Spren hate them. So
they would claim that they're the only order that didn't abandon their oaths back in the day. They've always been, if not around, in the background kind of as an order. However, they are now on the side of the Singers. So at what point did that switch? There had to be some stance at some point do we even see it in Oathbringer? Does Nail like make a decision that the Skybreakers are now on the Singer side?
He announces it.
Right.
I don't know if that was always his plan. Like, they've been off doing their own thing for thousands of years at right. this point.
And presumably, the Highspren are just fine with hunting and killing other Night Radiant, and they're just fine with that.
Yeah, there's some sort of like they care about the law of the right. land, and we've seen Nail manipulate the idea of the law, but it wasn't always like that. We saw in Rhythm of War, right, when Dalinar makes a connection with Nail, he sees some of Nail's past, and one of the quotes really sticks out to me of Nail giving a speech about how it's, you know, we need to make laws that serve the people or something along those lines. Like he says something about the law that I'm like, current day Nail would not say that. Current day Nail seems to just use the law to do whatever he wants to do.
Right.
So I don't know. There's some sort of problem with the Highspren, I think. And does this mean the Highspren are the only Spren left who had Radiance before the Recreants? Like, we were talking about that, I don't know if it was last week or the week before, where mm-hmm. Syl was one of the only ones. But the Highspren never became Deadeyes, presumably.
And there's always the possibility that there were Spren that had previously been bonded and weren't bonded at the time when they broke their oaths. There's no explanation one way or the other about that.
It was a war, though. So I think they were bonding as many as they could.
Yeah.
Anyway, I agree. Something's wrong with this Spren. Like he's not good for Zeth for sure. But maybe, I mean, there is kind of the argument of Zeth's kind of insane here and he kind of needs a steadying hand to be like, hey, don't get that emotional, because when you get emotional, things go kind of bad. So I don't know. Maybe it's the Spren trying his best to keep Zeth in line. And maybe he feels that Zeth needs that heavy hand.
Sanderson is the king of context, so I think we'll find out more.
That's a very lenient way to interpret how the Spren is acting.
Yeah. I'm just trying to fish out, is this the way Highspren are supposed to act or not?
Anything else from the Kaladin Zeth chapter? Okay. Chapter 20, which is three times the length of chapter 19. We have a very, very lengthy meeting of the monarchs. And he rolls out what is presumably the battle plot for the next like 3 or 4 days at least, and three different places are being assaulted: Thalen Island, Azir, Thalena, and the Shattered Plains. And when everything is said and done, Jasnah is going to Thalena, Sigzil is going to the Shattered Plains, and Adolin is going to Azir. Any thoughts on those? I have a couple, but
yeah, I think this chapter is kind of laying out just what plot lines are going to split off here. I'm mostly interested in seeing if we're going to get a bunch more Jasnah POVs, because I don't think Jasnah's bringing any normal POVs to Thalena. Is she?
Is she bringing anyone with her?
Yeah, that's what I'm asking.
Yeah, besides maybe Hoid.
Yeah, would Wit join her? I don't know. Wit seems to
be a little
preoccupied. I don't know what Hoid's going to do. Yeah, he's kind of preoccupied. I don't know if he would join her.
There's a slight possibility of... Oh, well, no, never mind. I was going to say Shallan, but no, she has her own thing.
Shallan and Jasnah do not hang out anymore.
Yeah, I was like, it's a tiny chance.
There's not much relationship there.
But do we get to see Jasnah being a super badass again?
Probably.
That's kind of the question there.
I wanted to talk about Sigsel real quick. Mm-hmm. So I'm reading Sunlit Man, and in chapter 32-ish, he has a cryptic line, as he does in that book, with Ox, and he's talking to Rebecca. And Rebecca says that there's some line about gathering a military against the Cinder King, and Sigsel has a line that says, "I've been an abandoned soldier before. I know what it's like to be abandoned on the battlefield." And I read that chapter literally back to back from this chapter, and I was like, "Okay, hold up. Are we going to lose the Shattered Plains? If there was anyone who is at danger of being cut off from the coalition out of these three, I would think it might actually be the Shattered Plains."
So we were talking not too long ago about how it didn't seem like Odium was the big bad of this book, and instead it might be Bada Mishram.
Right.
Are we still feeling that way? Or is there the potential that all of these battles lose?
That there is potential that all three of them lose. That nothing inherently... There's nothing inherent to the coalition that all three of these have to stand. But I think if one is most likely to stand, it's probably Thelena. Because like we've said before on the podcast here, we've already been there and done that, right? We already had the Battle of Thelena Field. And they talk about that in this chapter. They're like, we've already fought there. Why is he going for this? And then they talk about the owning the seas, moving forward, blah, blah, blah. But if one of these is a feint, I think it's actually going to be Thelena. And we're sending Jasnah, our best Radiant, to the feint. And the Shattered Plains and Aesir are to fall. That would be my prediction.
I think even if it's not a feint, Jasnah is the best Radiant. And people have no idea what she can do. So I think... if she can literally make a new wall in a moment like she did in the last battle, there's a good chance that they'll be able to hold out there.
So keep in mind, the last battle, we had Infinite Stormlight from Dalinar. Dalinar's not joining battles anymore, so he's not providing like his best... like that ability is insane, that he can just open a perpendicularity and just Infinite Stormlight for all the Radiance. And so that was the Jasnah we saw there, where just all the Radiants were just supercharged. We did see Jasnah fight with her armor briefly in Rhythm of War, and she was just like decimating an army all by herself. So she is definitely going to be a force to be reckoned with. I wonder how she's going to deal with ships, though, without any Windrunners.
Yeah.
I'm sure she's got some plan, though.
Yeah, it also has me thinking about Rissen and her ship. I'm sure. I hope we learn a little bit more.
Will a Dawn Shard come into play in this battle?
Where is Rissen?
We haven't heard from her, and it's really suspicious because we got Dawn Shard.
Right. Which
you're supposed to read Dawn Shard before Rhythm of War. It takes place before, but we don't get any Rissen, right?
Yeah.
Not at all.
So the last we've seen her is in Aesir?
Was there a chapter with
Aemia? I can't keep these two straight. The last we've seen her is picking up the Dawn Shard and talking to the There's an epilogue where they're somewhere else.
Yeah, they got back.
Yeah,
she might have been in the tower. I don't remember off the top of my head.
I mean, there's mention of all the soul casters she brought back.
That's true. That's true.
So she's back, but what's she doing? I think that's a wild card for sure. And if she's going to be anywhere, it's going to be Thelena, right?
Yeah.
And she has this Dawn Shard, and I would really like to know what's what that can do. The change Dawn Shard?
Yeah, we've been talking about Dawn Shards on the other podcast as well, because we're in Sunlight Man. And there's some mixed feelings on how involved Dawn Shard should be in Wind and Truth.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Talking about the Sunlight Man, I'm a little worried about Sigzil's Spren. You know, at some point he becomes a Skybreaker. Something happens to his Spren previously.
But also in Sunlit Man, it's hinted that it's his oaths that he damages his previous Spren with, not like a death. It's that he walked away from his Windrunner Spren, not something happened to it.
You've read Sunlit way more recently than I have, but what I came out with was his Spren, his Honor Spren dies. He gets a high Spren, and he becomes at least fourth level. I don't know, what do you call that?
Ideal.
Fourth level, fourth ideal Skybreaker. So right. he still hasn't become fourth ideal Windrunner, and he needs to. Because we know he was in Sunlit. He has some armor. His armor in Sunlit at the end is a mix between his Windrunner armor and his Skybreaker armor.
Yes.
So he needs to hit fourth ideal for Windrunner. And then his Spren has to die, and then he has to become a Skybreaker. And then he does a thing with a Dawn Shard and almost kills Oggs. And at some point, he also abandons all of his oaths and leaves. So I think that this is stuff that happens far future.
Right.
I don't even know if it's back half or like after back half.
Right.
Because that's a lot to do to get to fourth ideal and then fourth ideal again and have all those events happen. So maybe he hits fourth ideal this book. And maybe his Spren gets killed by Anti-Light this book. That's kind of what I was thinking. But it could also be like, I'm starting to think Sunlit has way fewer spoilers for Wind and Truth than we think it does.
Right. So on my first read of Sunlit, I agreed with everything that you just said, David. On this reread, though, it reads as if he walked away from oaths and they weren't auxiliary's oaths. At the time auxiliary is damaged, he is fourth ideal Skybreaker and alive and well. Like his oaths still work with auxiliary at the time of auxiliary's death. But it in the Brandon Sanderson way, it's a little wishy-washy there. And when he had a falling out with his oaths, who knows? And who knows whether we'll learn in this book or not.
I do think that Anti-Light's going to be a big part of at least one of these battles. And if it makes sense, I don't know, the pessimist in me says that there's a reason only one of them has a ton of fused. And it's to attract as many Radiants as possible to deploy Anti-Stormlight against them.
Yeah. So my problem with Anti-Light is we discovered it chronologically 2 days ago. Yeah. Three days ago, maybe. That seems like a stretch to weaponize it on today, like on day 8.
We did see L use it, though.
Sure.
Used Anti-Void Light, but they know how to make it.
Sure.
But and, yeah, I think it's going to be used sparingly just because they don't have much of it.
Right.
But I do think it will be used, this book.
And I think their current weapons, at least the heavenly ones, they're built to be able to draw out stormlight. Right. So it makes sense they'd be able to reverse engineer that.
Sure. Okay.
See, I would expect... Now, we didn't see any fused use it in the cognitive realm.
Correct. We've only seen it used twice, and that was Moash and L in the previous book. Hasn't shown up yet.
Yeah. So we'll see.
What else in the meeting of monarchs? The Dalinar and Adolin scene. Do you guys have strong feelings about this Dalinar and Adolin stuff that's been going on since, like, Oathbringer?
I think that, and this is going to be controversial, I think that Adolin is struggling with some kind of oath, with some kind of ideal.
Like, and I think it's forgiveness?
That has to do with, yeah, something along those lines.
Okay.
And I wonder if he's kind of inventing his own Radiant Order through his weird bond with Maya.
Okay.
So, like, whenever a character is really struggling with, like, I know I should do this, but I'm struggling with it, like, that happens over and over again. And that tells me that they're struggling with some ideal, a Radiant ideal, but he's not a Radiant. So, I don't know. I know a lot of people are like, just leave Adolin alone. It's okay that he's not Radiant. But I don't know if Sanderson's going to do that. And if he doesn't, maybe there's something new happening here. And that might be interesting on its own. It's not exactly, you know, the Edge Dancer oaths.
Right.
Of remembering. But maybe there's something going on there. That's the only reason I can think of to, like, really draw out Adolin forgiving his father. I also think maybe Dalinar is just a bad dad. And I think that this plays into him ignoring Gavinor enough for Gavinor to become Odium's champion.
Okay.
Because Gavinor does not have a father figure, and Dalinar is not it.
Right. I mean, yeah. Honestly, it probably should be Adolin.
Yeah.
But Adolin hasn't been around.
Yeah.
Adolin's
not a dad either, though.
Yeah, it's true. I think part of this is that Dalinar was never a good dad, like you were saying. And Adolin had him built up in the first few books as he's amazing, he's this awesome guy, and he's going through that phase that I've gone through, and many people I know in their early 20s, realizing, okay, my parents, I built them up to be something that they're not. And in his situation, he built them up and it came crashing down with just about the worst thing that you could ever find out that your dad did. And he's having a hard time recovering. Whether that ends up being a Radiant Order, I think that could fit very well with him and Yonagon both feeling like they're not living up to their station.
Mm-hmm.
But even if it's just a regular trauma,
yeah.
I like that he's acknowledging we love Dalinar, we root for him. He's got problems that we need to work through.
I didn't miss that Adolin is going with Yonagon. I thought that was interesting. That, what was it, last episode? We talked about Adolin and Yonagon have this random conversation in the elevator that turns out to be pretty cool. And then Adolin volunteers to go defend Aesir. So I think Adolin might be in my top three storylines moving forward of seeing where he goes in this book. I'm very interested on, David, what you were talking about, if the forgiveness has something to do with moving forward for Adolin. Obviously it does, but in what context, what capacity? And then some friendship with Yonagon. Does Aesir end up on the side of Odium? And then Adolin and Yonagon are stuck there in Odium's empire. Like, what is going on with Adolin? It's really interesting.
I think they have a lot to learn from each other. If we remember, we had the, of course you remember, I think it was last week. I'm getting chapters mixed up. I think it was last week we had Adolin's POV in the war in the Meeting of Kings.
Yes.
And he is surprised at Yonagon defending Dalinar.
Right.
Yonagon has really grown and matured quite a bit. And I think Adolin even thinks maybe I should have matured too. So putting them together, like, this is really setting it up to be like Yonagon will help Adolin and Adolin will help Yonagon. And so that's a pairing that I never expected, but I think it will be interesting.
And not that I think this will happen, but I could see Adolin's city, or Yonagon's city that Adolin is in, falling, and then Adolin somehow being manipulated into being Odium's champion. I could see that. I don't think that will happen, but it's with what we have so far of, you know, Adolin really seething at Dalinar, going back to the tower as his champion. I could see that happening. I don't think it will, though.
Yeah, I mean, it could be a setup to be like, let's justify why Adolin would fight his father.
Right.
I don't like it personally.
I think it falls flat because it's not just fighting his father, it's also fighting everyone.
There's kind of that classic grooming where the evil entity grooms, you know, groom someone to switch sides, right? And to be like, oh, our side is actually the good side, and here's why, right? You know, Star Wars-esque.
Right. Well, and that's what, I mean, not exactly that, but that's what Odium tried to do in Oathbringer. He's been trying to groom Dalinar for years. Dalinar flips on him. Odium retreats, tries again with Adolin, maybe? I don't know. I mean, I could see it.
Odium has successfully groomed many.
Right.
All of the Fused. Basically all the Singers. Because originally, Odium came with the humans. So early on, he gets all the Singers on his side, even though the humans abandoned him. And then also he did it to Moash. He almost did it to Kaladin too. So, like, I don't know. It seems to just be his thing. Like, the way he talked to Dalinar over and over again of being like, look, I'm a kind guy, right? I care about passion, not hatred, you know?
Yeah. What'd you guys think of the Stormfather sibling relationship at like the very beginning of this chapter? The Stormfather, the sibling, Dalinar, and Navani have a four-way conversation. And this is the first time we've ever seen this. And both of them are talking to both Dalinar and Navani. I thought that was very odd that we haven't. I mean, I guess this would have been one of the first times we got to see this, but the sibling and the Stormfather relationship seemed like estranged siblings, like they haven't talked in a while. I don't know if that's true, but that's how it came off to me.
Well, we do know the sibling has been pretending to be dead for a while.
Fair enough.
Yeah, I didn't really like care too much about the mechanics of that, because, you know, Spren can kind of choose who hears them. And Stormfather has like talked to people before, like he talked to Kaladin. What did stand out to me is this quote from the sibling. I miss how the Stormfather used to be. He was so much happier before, not so angry all the time. And this kind of leads into all the theories about the Stormfather is different now. And maybe that's what we were supposed to get out of the prologue, is that the Stormfather is different. Not that it wasn't the Stormfather in the prologue, but just that, ooh, the Stormfather is not who we think he is. And, you know, we got the thing from cultivation that there's the latent power of honor. And I have a few thoughts around this, and I'll do them one at a time. But the first thought is, in Mistborn, Laris kind of instructs the Mists to find a successor. But he had a specific successor in mind, which was Vin. And so that worked out pretty well. The Mists were constantly trying to just ascend Vin, and Vin had the earring, which prevented that. What if kind of the latent power of honor, of Tanavast, what if that was put into the Stormfather with the instruction to find a new vessel? And that's really the goal of sending the visions and all this other stuff, what the Stormfather's been doing. His goal is to find an appropriate vessel for honor. To me, that kind of clicked things into place. I wanted to get your opinions on that, though.
That does make a lot of sense. And I think the Stormfather is fighting that. And we can see in his words, he doesn't want Dalinar to know more about his whole situation. So if it is that, either he's trying to hold on to the power or he doesn't trust. It makes sense more that he just doesn't trust a mortal to be able to make wise decisions.
I don't know if I have too much to add. I don't know.
Okay. Well, the second thing is Navani has a conversation with the sibling. Like, the sibling's like, hey, Radiance, we never could do that before with the map, right? This isn't the first time we've heard, hey, Radiance couldn't do that before.
Right.
And Navani's like, well, you know, when you're blank slate, you're going to discover things, you know, because you don't have the, however she explains it, you know, you don't have the past, like,
to the bias. Yeah.
Yeah. The bias towards that. I don't buy this explanation. I don't think it's right. I do think there's some, it could be, you know, honor was putting limits on all the radiant powers. And he's not doing that anymore. Maybe cultivation never cared to do so. It seems like putting limits on powers is more of a contract thing than a cultivation thing, a growth thing. So maybe because there's only cultivation's influence now and not honors, that, you know, the radiant powers are growing in certain ways. That feels like a better explanation to me, but I wonder if there's even more going on there. Do you buy Navani's explanation or not?
I'm with you. And I have a question. Would you then assume that it would revert if someone were to hold honor again? Would they then bind it again?
I would think that would be up to the vessel.
Right.
But I think, so is it naturally that the power of honor wants to limit the radiant powers, or is this more like Tanavast decided that would be a good idea and it was irrelevant to the power?
So presumably the radiant powers predate honor and having to do with honor, because they had them with Odium, right?
They had void binding with Odium.
It wasn't like the humans had void binding with Odium. Is that?
Yeah.
Okay.
They used void binding to destroy Ashen.
Right. So then is that why honor is limiting it, or was, and it no longer is?
Yeah. I mean, honor probably doesn't want Roshar destroyed.
Right.
So I think that makes a lot of sense to me to be like, hey, let's limit what humans can do here.
I've got a couple of thoughts. First, I remember when Syl first sees the Honor Blade, the Honor Blade that Zeth uses, she describes it as a radiant bond, unbounded, not set with the same limits that come with having a spren. And I think honor with that, is okay with that, because they were bound by their original contract, the Oath Pact. And then on a second part, Yes. So Noadam, I remember he founded the Knights Radiant as a way to unify. And I think I remember setting limits on what could be done, because the Radiants, well, I mean, they weren't the Knights Radiant, but the Surge Binders were fighting each other, divided by nation lines, all that kind of stuff. So I wonder how much of that was setting actual limits and not just a reorganization.
I will say that the limitation imposed by the Spren is not necessarily of honor's doing, because we see an example of that, which is Zeth is like, I know how to use what's the power that what starts with D?
Division.
He's like, I know how to use Division. He trained on all the honor blades. So he's like, I know how to use Division, but I don't have access to it because my friend won't let me. So like the Spren has a choice. And then like when Shallan wanted to soul cast, right? She had to get permission from Pattern to do it. So the Spren have the ability to withhold the power based on whether the Radiant is following the contract. And that's still in effect. So I don't know if maybe there's an additional layer beyond that, which is that honor used to limit things. Like we see that Dalinar is a bondsmith unchained. Isn't that literally one of the chapter titles?
Yes.
Dalinar is doing all sorts of things that he shouldn't be able to do. So something like honor would be like, hey, let's limit what the bondsmiths can do. Let's limit what all the orders can do to a certain degree to prevent disasters. Beyond the Spren limitations of the oaths.
I've got one more point I'd like to move on to if we're done with this discussion.
What you said was interesting about Noadon, because I think that's accurate, that Noadon introduced the sort of structure of saying oaths to gain the powers, and you have to follow the oaths. I always felt like that was of the Spren too. So I wonder how Noadon did that. Was he a bondsmith? Was he able to adjust how things worked? I don't know. I just had this random thought. Like, is Noadon still around? Like,
it was, that would be a sense.
Like,
it was tossed around on when we were opening Sunlit that Noadon was the Sunlit Man before we figured out it was Stigzel.
Yeah. Like, is he a cognitive shadow? Did he ascend in some way in order to adjust how the magic worked? Like, we know Ishar created the Oath Pact, but the Heralds had nothing to do with the forming of the Radiance. So there's a hole missing there, and I don't quite understand it.
If I'm not mistaken, Noadon doesn't found the Knights Radiant. The Knights Radiant are founded off of Noadon's writings.
Yeah. But like the vision with Noadon, the first one that Dalinar has, which I think is a true vision from the past, as opposed to the weird one where they're shopping in the marketplace. In that one, he's talking about Surge Binders still. So yeah, I think if we delved deeper into like random lines in the text, we might be able to figure out more. But I think this is one of the things we're going to learn as Dalinar explores the past through the spiritual realm. I think this is going to be an excuse to get certain flashbacks to explain certain things, because I really want to know. I have no idea what's going on.
I like that. I like that. I'm a lore nerd like you guys, so I like learning more.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to talk about Odium and Taravangian. I remember we talked about this last week as well, but I've got this quote from the chapter. The old Odium was deeply calcified into his position as a god and was very unlikely to do anything that would risk that position. So for Taravangian, how much is he being affected by Odium? How much is Odium affecting him, kind of back and forth? And based on this quote, it's like saying that race calcify definitely implies time and a brittleness. So is this just that Taravangian is new to godhood and so he can do things that race couldn't, or is there part of it that I just lost my train of thought there.
Well, I will say we have an example of this with Sazed, right? The thing Sazed did when he first got the power, like when he first ascended, he can't do that anymore. Right, he recreated the whole world in exactly the way he wanted to, and I mean, even 300 years later, he's now like super limited by his powers and what he's able to do. And
right.
I think we kind of learn that over time the power affects the vessel. Do we even have, like, is that like one of Hoid's letters where he mentions that? I have a brief like spark of like maybe he mentioned that there, but there's somewhere that we learn more about this, where it's hinted at that eventually the power consumes the vessel and the vessel is super affected by the intent of the power and cannot diverge from it. So I feel like that's what's being talked about here. Calcified is a good word because like at some point you just become rigid like stone. You know, that's what calcification is, right? You were a form that could change, but then now that, you know, all the calcium has entered you and hardened you up, now you can't change anymore, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just remembered my second point. So
okay,
the old Odium, do you think part of it was that he was calcified into the position of power as being a god and he didn't want to risk dying, and that Taravangian is more open to being killed off as long as his goal is able to be achieved?
Yeah, that's interesting, definitely. I would think Raze's personality would be one of not wanting to give up the power. But is there some aspect that the power itself is going to influence the vessel to not want to give it up? I mean, okay, we have another example of Vin, right? Vin ascended for a very short time, but she literally like rams herself into ruin knowing that she's going to die.
Right? Yeah,
but she takes ruin with her. So she obviously at that point did not have that calcified position as a god, right? So maybe that's the worry, right? Like Taravangian could do something similar to what Vin did if he wanted to.
Not very Whereas, preservation of her.
Yeah, not very preservation of it, right? So when you first ascend, you've got a lot more ability to kind of do what you want, but then it calcifies into being very rigid. Yeah, I don't know if wanting to stay a vessel is part of that, or if that's just the personality of the vessels. Really good question.
Anything else?
Wasn't a half an hour.
It was not half an hour. All right. We can close it there and reconvene next week with whatever we get from Tor. So thanks for joining me, David and Tim.
Thanks for having us.
Ciao.